Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2018. Lecture 17, delivered on March 28, 2018. The title of this lecture is Break-Even and Sensitivity Analysis.
Today, break-even analysis and sensitivity analysis. Before I do that, however, I want to bring up a follow-up on what I started on Monday. You might recall that on Monday, I simulated, this was a simulation, I simulated a position. Do you remember what the stock was that I did? No, this was the thing at the beginning. FedEx was the whole lecture. Yeah? Facebook. And what did I do? Do you remember?
Sure.
I sure did. It was 160, I think it was 06, right? So I buy at market, or rather, I'm sorry, I took my position short 1,000 shares FB at 160.06, and I put the cover at, what was the cover? Do you remember? Well, 150 or better. Whoops. 150 or better. Let's see what happens. What's happened? Okay. You ever notice the pictures of our university always have the good-looking people? They never have a picture of me or you. Okay, here we go. Ride the dog, FB. Now, since I took the position at about 5 o'clock on Monday, oh dear God, what was the day's range? Anyone see it? What was the day's range? Do you see it? Day's range? Say it loudly, the exact numbers. $150.80 to 100. Do you see how close I came to covering? I came 80 cents from covering that ridiculous position there. No, seriously, I want to make sure you see it. I said close this thing if it got to $150 or lower. It came within 80 cents of doing that. I was looking at this before class, about 2 hours before class. I almost had a heart attack. Are you kidding me? I came within 80 cents on a, that's a stupid position. That's a $10 drop, and sure enough, this thing almost did it. So right now, I'm 2 days out into the, without covering. And then the next question. Now, you understand here, it would cost me money to do it. But I could actually, the stock closed at where did the stock close at? 150, about 153, wasn't it? What was the settle? Last settle was 153.03. Now, I could actually close now, and it would cost me to change the order details, but I could still make a penny off this. I mean, if I closed at 153, I could buy the stock at 153, 153.50, something like that. I didn't look at the, didn't ask. And I would still pocket $7,000 because it'd be $7 per share for 1,000 shares on the short position. I'd still pull $7,000 or so. There'd be commission and some paddling for doing it like that. But $7,000, actually, that would make for us to have a hellacious pizza party. I mean, $10,000, I'd get Papa John's. $7,000, you're going to get Little Caesars, okay? Extra cheese, no pineapple, for God's sake. What is it with that? Okay, anyway, no shrimp. Okay, but you see that I actually came awfully close. You see, if the stock price had hit on that downstroke there, sometime during the day, the stock price, there was a point when it got to 150.80. If it had gotten to 150 on the button, instantly I would have closed. I would have covered. And it would have been over right there. Right now, it's not over. I'm sitting here saying, okay, I'm 2 days out without covering. Do I keep going here? Or do I cut and run and take the money that I've got? Question. Let's start this out. What say you? Should I hold on and see if it comes back down and hits the limit order book entry right now? Or do I quit and walk away and take my money? Say it. Hold on. Okay. Now, what would you do, ma'am? Would you take your $7,000 or would you hold and keep going? See if it comes down to 150 or 149 or whatever. You take what you got?
Yeah,
okay, very good. Very good. Okay, what would you do, sir?
I take the money.
See, it all depends on your risk level in playing the numbers. This is betting. This is gambling. There are some people, I've been at a 21 table where I saw people, they'd get one hand, they'd win one hand, and they'd walk away. And then there were others, they'd win one hand, and they'd just keep rolling because they figured that they were on a roll. It all depends on your tolerance for aggravation and risk. I'll show you the argument. The argument for just walking now is obvious. I've got money. I've got cheeseburgers for the next month. I've got enough money, I might even have a few friends. That kind of thing. Let's look at the 5-day here. Facebook has been getting its butt smacked. The thing that worries me the most is, do you see that now I have ascending tops? Oh, I'm sorry, bottoms. Do you see each bottom over the last 5 days? The neckline is going up. That's a little worrying. In other words, the downstrokes, each one is not as hard as the last one. So in other words, that downstroke that took it to $150.80, I might not see that again because it looks like the trend line is showing that the bottoms are not going as deep every time. That would tell me that it might be a good idea, as you were the one who said, walk. Now, some of you have said, let's keep going here. The argument for continuing to hold on to this would basically come down. Well, there would be what I'm doing here is ELF. That was ELF stuff. In other words, technical chart stuff, which is something you shouldn't do in public company, in polite company. But I might say, Let's see what's going on with the short interest. Short interest is increasing. Do you see that? That means that the bears still are thinking that there's room downward. The short interest is fairly strong. My days to cover, where's my days to cover? 1.5 days to cover. Right now, I'm out past that at 2 days. That bothers me a little bit. I'm walking a lot farther into a desert than pros are by holding on even as long as I have 2 days. But at the same time, I don't see a strong short interest float percent of float. So it might be that there were some who just chickened out. Or it could be that they didn't take positions nearly as dangerous as I did. They might have covered at 155, 156, something like that. So what I'm seeing here is that the days to cover was covering people with much smaller spreads between market and cover. Hard to call. It's your choice. It's what do you think is going to happen? Facebook, your point was well taken. There seems to be a little bit of recovery momentum here. But at the same time, I might just be a greedy son of a bitch and just want to keep riding this. And if I lose, I just say, well, I was just pretending anyway. And if I win, then I'm going to say, darn it, I should have done this position. I should have actually done this. But you see, it has to do with your individual willingness to hold on and just keep playing. And it can be scary. Go. Okay, now remember this. Beta measures its volatility in a well-diversified portfolio. So what this may be is that Facebook is just behaving unusually compared to what it would normally do with respect to the market as a whole. And we don't want something that overreacts and changes just because of a little stroke downward. We also want to make sure that in a case like this, and sometimes you have to watch out for these things like Yahoo Finance, their betas might not be as up-to-date as you might want. That's another problem. But the third and compelling factor in this right now is that, you see, I'm in a naked position here. I am not in a well-diversified portfolio. I'm riding raw risk, not risk in the market with relative to the market portfolio. This short position, I'm just taking it and I'm taking all of the volatility I can buy and hoping for the best. But the answer to your question is that I think over time, if Facebook doesn't control itself, the price remains volatile, you will see the beta start to increase. It would not be the first company that had when I was a kid, I made a couple of things that were like explosives. Okay, now they made boom sounds, okay? And everyone, oh, isn't that cute? Fat Boy made a big boom. And everything was cool until there came a time when I got to be much older and I got a little bit more knowledgeable about chemicals. And I once packed a rocket with what is essentially like a gunpowder. And I launched it so that when it was supposed to burn out, the last part of the rocket engine fired hot stuff into the mixture. The explosion shook the center of the small town I lived in. Okay? And then no one trusted me again. But all those years when I was just a cute little kid doing the little things, my beta was very low. Everyone thought I was just quite riskless. It was only after I had gotten more mature It was only when I showed extraordinary irresponsibility as a mature citizen of the corporate community of the world that suddenly, perhaps a Facebook is going to face what adult companies have to face, reputation. You see, Mark Zuckerberg was the love child of Wall Street. His stock was loved by all these trust funds, mutual funds, investment funds. But now that he has done some, and so the beta was reflecting low volatility, large holdings by large investment funds that would not buy and sell cause volatility. Now that he has grown up, Zuckerberg and Facebook has shown that it can do global damage. Suddenly, those funds are beginning to move that stock back and forth harder. That will ultimately reflect in the beta. So your question is quite valid, but in a longer-term sense. Why is the beta so low if this company is acting up so much price-wise? Well, the beta will begin to reflect that unless Zuckerberg and the whole Facebook club starts showing that it is never going to do that again, it's going to convince us that it's never going to do that again, and that anyone who was responsible for it is going to get his ass kicked out of the company. But until they do that, and I don't think they're going to do that. I think what they're going to do is they just think they're going to ride it out, and then these funds that hold massive amounts of Facebook stock, they're going to start playing with that like they do other stocks. Sell, buy, price volatility, beta goes up. Good question. Moving away from that, I will give you the final update on Monday. Let me try this. Okay. Now, the best way to survive is not to be brave, it's to be a coward. To hide. And in a market, in the stock market, you will assume that regardless, I'm going to quit on Friday at the end of the trading day or sometime shortly before the end of the trading day. If I cover, if it goes below 150 and it covers on its own, wonderful. If it doesn't, I'm just going to shut down the enterprise. And then we'll look on Monday to see what the final result was of what I did here. But one way or the other, This is the real deal. This is what you would do. And so you know something that most people, probably 99% of people in this country, in the world, don't understand. People think that you make money when a stock price goes up. That's only half the ways you can make money. You can make money when a stock price goes down. This is the other side. So capital gains doesn't always mean price appreciation. If you are a short seller, then capital losses for everyone else are your capital gains. So if you are an investor who bets on stock prices of Facebook going up, and I am an investor who bets on Facebook going down, your gain is my loss, but your loss is an extra martini and my lunch at a decent restaurant, okay, and a Reuben and another layer of Reuben sandwich meat, okay. So keep that in mind. There are two sides to the market. You can make money. Most people don't know that there is plenty of money to be made on the downstroke, just like there is money to be made on the upstrokes too. Just depends on which way you want to bet and what your general ability to tolerate risk is. Now, moving on to the main topic today, I've got to find someone who looks like, okay, you, sir. Yes. You are going to major in finance, right? Finance, right? No, don't give up. Fine. Argue with me. Okay, but you realize, no, this isn't what I want for my life. I want to do something interesting. I want to buy cheap soy candles and sell them at art shows. Okay, have you ever been to an art show, ma'am? You've seen those places that sell little trinkets. you know, like the soy candles, the bath salts, the knitted or the little signs that have sappy sayings about the family that you know doesn't exist in real life at all anywhere, or the guy that sells the sunglasses and all that kind of stuff. I mean, that was your dream. So you finally lived your dream. Okay, so the question, though, is, what kind of a dream is this? And if I were to do financial analysis at the real life level, look, we do net present values, internal rates of return, cash flow analysis, capital asset pricing model. We do those things, ratios. But if you are actually in business, there's something that is really, really important to you that is hard to replace. That is profit, period. Do I have money in my pocket at the end of the day? I've spent money. Do I have money? Did I actually make more than I spent? Realistically, that's that cash flow thing I keep talking about. Now, let's put it into real terms here. Now, you probably, I hope, you saw this in an economics class. But whether or not you did, I wanted to sort of make it have more teeth, more realism to it. There is obviously profit in its simplest sense is going to be your revenues minus your costs. That's just the reality. I mean, you can do, well, where are we talking about accounting costs or opportunity costs, replacement costs? Okay, let's get all that out of the way, and let's just get down to the brass tacks. And here I'm beginning to talk to you like I am a business person. I'm going to show you my own business's numbers in one example here. But right now, okay, in your economics class, there should have been a place where they separated costs into two columns. There were the variable costs, and there were the fixed costs. Now, if you're actually in business, you would probably not call them this. In a smaller business, the variable costs, you would say your wholesale. That's your wholesale. Those are the costs that go up when your sales are up. They go down when your sales are down. They are not a source of business risk, of financial risk, because they move. If you don't sell as much at some point, you don't have as many of these costs. This cost goes down. If you sell more, then you have more of those costs. That's an important consideration. This is, variable costs are actually desirable to the extent that they're not going to destroy you in a bad market. If I have a bad art show, my variable costs are not what's going to bite me in the ass. It's those fixed costs, which we generally, in real business, you would hear those called overhead. Overhead. Now, there's a little bit of spillover in common parlance, but it's a good way to think about it. Overhead, those are the costs that are going to be there whether or not you sell any of your product. You, sir, are going to have the variable costs, the wholesale cost of each of those soy candles that you buy, or the materials that it costs to make them. Okay? That's variable. You sell more, the variable cost goes up. You sell less, fewer, the variable cost is lower. The fixed costs are the costs you pay for having an exhibition booth at the festival, the cost of your display area, the tables, the tents, because those are going to be there whether you sell zero or a million of your candles. Those are the ones that can hurt you. Because as it's great. When your sales are very high, your per unit fixed costs are low. Yeah, you know, because you've got a bigger number divided by the same cost. But if you don't sell, those things are murder on you. I'll give you an example. At one show last year, I had paid one show, and that was a show that sucked. $225 booth fee. I'd already paid a $25 application fee. So my total fixed costs were there, but there was more to it than that because I have all this display area, and over a year I would divide that up. Okay, I have 8 shows, and so like if I've got about $1,000, it'd be about 1,600, just to make a round number, 1,600 in other than over 8 shows, that would be $200 a show for those fixed, the tent, those pop-up tents and the display racks and the tables. So the total of my fixed cost here would be $450. Now, this show, I didn't sell anything. Didn't sell a thing. So, essentially, I was creamed to the tune of $450. No revenue, cost. No variable cost, because I didn't sell anything. I didn't have any variable costs associated with the show. No wholesale cost. But my fixed costs murdered me on that show. I made a profit of negative $450. The fixed costs are how much in the hole you are before you sell your first unit. The fixed costs are how far you are in the hole before you sell your first unit. And every unit you sell is crawling one more notch out of that hole that you created with your fixed costs. That's why there are companies that are obsessed with controlling overhead. We've got to cut our overhead, because that's how it's destroying us. That can go only so far, and many companies got so obsessed with controlling their overhead because of the fear. Overhead is your negative profit if you don't sell anything. And so companies became obsessed with controlling fixed costs. And they did it to the point where they destroyed their company. A JCPenney. Well, we don't have a fixed cost of upgrading our stores. We don't want to do that. We don't have to do that. Leave the stores alone. Lower that overhead. Get rid of some of our salaried executives, those academic airheads. We don't need them. That's a fixed cost. Let's get the lights dimmed down in our stores. Yeah, that'll lower our overhead. You been into a JCPenney lately? Ma'am, have you? Let me tell you, you will meet your grandmother's ghost in there. You pick something up, a nice dress, that smells like grandma. Ugh. You put it down. They just did not understand that there's only so far this cost control mania can take you before it ruins you. It's like all those oil refineries along the southern coast of the United States. They stopped maintaining the refineries. They stopped building new refineries. Hadn't been one built since the 1970s, a new one. We're controlling our overhead. Yeah, and those refineries started blowing up in the 21st century. Explosion after explosion. Hundreds of people killed. Workers, townspeople. When those cost savings on overhead came back to bite the companies in the ass. So there's only so far you can lower your fixed cost. I could do a show without a pop-up tent. Oh, that's a great idea. And then the rain comes and I ruin my show. Stuff like that. Or I don't need those tables. Oh, well, where am I going to put my promo materials? Oh, I'll just hold them like this for people. Now, there's only so much you can do to control those costs. Okay. Now, let me take this a little further now. And this is actually very simple math, but it's important math because this is more like the math that really is at the down-to-earth level of business. But there's a little bit of arithmetic and algebra in here. Look, what we're saying here, revenue is actually the price per unit times the number of units you sell. your price per unit times, I mean, duh. I charge $10 a unit, I sell 50, I make $500. Now, the variable cost would be the variable cost per unit times the number of units I sell. The little V there represents the per unit variable cost, your per unit wholesale, as it were. Now, I'm using that term wholesale a little bit loosely here, but it's actually pretty darn accurate. So when you look at financial statements of a company, you see that COGS line, cost of goods sold? That's, yeah, there's your variable cost, your total variable cost, right there. And all those lines below it, selling general administrative expenses, depreciation, capital expense, whatever you want to call it, talk about, those are fixed costs. Your wages and salaries, those are fixed costs. Research and development expenses, those are fixed costs. They don't vary with how many units you sell. They are just there. So it's actually on accounting financial statements. It's a little blurred. I will stipulate that, but it's still pretty clean. Okay, now the fixed costs are just fixed costs. There is no times n or anything. They're just there. They just sit there. So in other words, I can write profit equals the price per unit times n units that I sell minus, open parenthesis, the variable cost per unit times the number of unit plus the fixed costs, close parenthesis. That would be more of an algebraic representation. Nothing hard. Now, doing the distributive law of subtraction, profit is P times N minus V times N, distributing that minus sign over there, minus FC. Okay. Now I'm going to do something here. I'm going to gather together the N's. Profit is equal to the quantity P minus little V times N. Minus FC, okay? I'm going to show you, tell you something here. This is an old term, and you got to be careful because it's kind of non-aligned with other terms similar to it. But you see this little price per unit minus variable cost per unit? The old word, the old term for that, we called it the unit margin. We called it our unit margin. It's just a good number to know. Okay, you buy the soy candles for $2 each. You sell them for $5 each. Your unit margin is $3. That word margin usually should be associated with a ratio. But this is such an old term, and it's just a clean, nice term. Older time business people use it. Even some of the new business people, especially at art shows and at small, with small companies that make small products, that we still, they still, and I still say unit margin. Little of the price per unit minus variable cost per unit. Okay, so now, The next question here is this. How many units do I have to sell in order to get, see, I'm in the dirt. At N units, I've lost fixed cost. So how many units do I have to sell to get the profit up to zero? That's called my break-even N. Now, I even put a little star on this. Sometimes you'll see it written with a little BE there up on the top or down on the bottom. But what that means, that's the number of units I have to sell in order to cross from negative to positive profit. Now I'm going to do a little bit of algebra. Add fixed cost to both sides, FC. then divide both sides by unit margin, P minus V. So my break-even number of units is going to be my fixed cost over my unit margin. You see it? Notice something. Oh, notice a couple of things. The higher my overhead, the bigger that break-even number is. The wider, the bigger my unit margin is, the lower the break-even number of units is. Again, that last one. The bigger the gap between P and V, the smaller the number of units I have to sell to break even. Okay? Now I'll show you a real example, an actual example. I did this once before, and now I'm going to do it again for you. This one's actually the numbers that I meant to bring my paper along. I had the numbers, and I think I remember them okay. This is my own business. I'm going to show you one product category, my break-even for it on a season. Okay. My 24-inch by 16-inch. I sell them at $500 a piece. On average, and this is an approximate, frame, high quality frame, museum glass, matted, acid-free mat, dry mount backing, wire dust cover, the whole nine yards. The average variable cost, in other words, what is associated with the item I'm going to sell, runs $175. Okay. Now, on a per show basis, and I will average a cost for the booth fee, $225. Pay the application fee, generally $50. And then I do about 8 shows a year. And so the $1,600 in fixed equipment, I would want to put that for 8 shows. And I give my fixed cost per show $200. For $1,600 worth of equipment. You know, the pop-up tent, the racks, the tables, economic depreciation of my equipment, all that. So right there, that's my fixed cost. So now I can actually calculate break-even. Fixed cost, $475 over $500 minus $175. So my unit margin is $325. All right. Yeah. Now, just cranking it up here. $475 divided by $325. Let's try that again. $475 divided by 325. Now, last question. Ma'am, how many do I have to sell? Good. That's what I wanted. See, that's a trick. I was waiting for you to say 1.46. No, I can't sell 1.46. My break even is 2. At every show, I have to sell 2 of this product category. And you don't spill across. You do each product category on its own. That's an incremental analysis. You've seen in the book they've mentioned. This is the real part of it. Each product category I will break off on its own. So every show, I better sell 2 of those in order for me to break even, to make it worth me doing that. Now, here's the interesting thing. The next part, that's break-even analysis, okay? Simple. The next part, now there are a lot of different parts to what I'm about to show you. But for realistic purposes, if you're on the ground and you're grinding out your product and selling it with the other gypsies, tramps, and thieves at the shows and all that kind of stuff, you don't do a lot of the real fancy stuff. But the basic idea here is of what I'm going to do. It's called sensitivity analysis. Now, in general, sensitivity analysis says change some of the parameters up and down to see what kind of an effect comes of it. Okay? Now, the one that really interests me, look, I mean, I can't really, realistically, I can't do a whole lot with my fixed costs. I mean, over time, I can find efficient things that can reduce them somewhat. But thinking that I can dramatically lower my fixed costs in a given season, nah, I'm not going to do that. Okay. Sensitivity analysis. If you've got multi-year cash flow and you're finding net present values, yeah, it might be a good idea to change your discount rate back and forth to see how sensitive your break-even is and all that with that one. There are a few other parameters you can change as well. How about wholesale? Can we bring down our wholesale costs? I'll talk about that in a little bit. But for me right now, my question would be, how much would I have to raise my price in order for me to get to a break-even of 1? Of my artworks at a show sold to break-even. Well, now you can do this algebraically, but it's almost, in a way, if people are talking to me about getting into business, I really recommend you do it. Just hammer it out, because then it makes you think harder. Okay, suppose that I had, instead of $500, I jacked my prices up to $550. Okay? So I'll do $475 divided by what happened? Okay, 475 divided by, I see, open parentheses, 550 minus 175. Close parentheses. I still have to sell 2. Okay, let's get aggressive here. Let's say I jack my price up to 600, okay? 475 divided by, open parenthesis, 600 minus 175. Now, some of you are saying, well, couldn't you do this like an algebra? Yeah, I could, but I'm getting to a point here. No, that's not right. Let me do that again. 475 divided by, open parenthesis, 600 minus 175. Close the parenthesis. There we go. 600. So let me just jack my prices up to 600. Good idea? Probably not. I have to ask myself something that comes down to, the fancy term in economics is price elasticity of demand. Yeah, I'll get more money by selling at 600 than at 500, but I might also scare away customers. If I brought in some of my artwork, it's actually in my car, you would see, interestingly enough, you would see that I am holding Priceline at 500 because it would take too much over that for me to break down so I could sell one instead of two for break even. And I know that at 600, I'm getting a little too rich for my own market, for my market. I'm not a $600 artist yet. In a couple of years, with a couple of more reviews in art magazines, yeah, but not now. So you see, that's where you have this difficult situation. I really want to sell fewer units to break even. But in order to do that, I have to ask myself, what am I going to do? Okay, I can reduce my overhead. Good luck with that. Okay, I can cut my wholesale prices, okay, or I can jack up my prices. Every one of them has a consequence. Every one of them has a negative consequence, as well as the positive consequence of a lower break-even unit per unit, number of units. It's just the reality. That's where business, it's not all just do what you want. The mathematics and the human economic behavior ties your hands behind your back. Okay, there's where I'm standing right now. And this is just a real example of it. It's a simple example, but sometimes complicated things have to be complicated. Sometimes the simple gets the point across, and it's what we actually have to do in the real life. So I just wanted you to see that one. Now, I'm going to go on to another topic that's related. It's part of this, too. And now, if you are up in Schaumburg at the end of, or in the southwest suburbs area of Chicago at the end of May, there's an art festival there called the Prairie Art Festival. Now, come to my booth. You can't afford my stuff, so just come in and shut the hell up if you don't like it. Otherwise, you just go crazy and say, my rich family is going to buy everything here and see if you can get some. Anyway, now, but you're going to see that there is not one product. There are several different products. Now, I'm going to come bring this around to something that sounds like it's somewhat different, but it's all part of this. And I'm going to ask a question. I'm trying to see if someone who might be kind of like really an interested expert in this, and I'm trying to see someone who might be able to answer my question. Okay, sir, you. You know what cannibalism is?
Yeah.
Okay, what is it?
Eating humans.
Well, you eat your own kind, okay? So some years ago, I, when I was spending time out west, I realized, you know, I'm really excited when I see these exotic animals, like buffalo, like a golden eagle, like an elk. Why am I not excited when I see a cow or a pig or a chicken? Well, it occurred to me it's because I have never eaten a buffalo or an elk. But I have eaten cows and pigs.
Yep.
And then it kind of occurred to me, that's why I get so excited when people come to my door and ring the doorbell.
Makes sense.
Yeah, I know, right? Hey, you're sitting there very calmly. You should be, okay. No. The thing of it is, though, that the term cannibalism in business, in marketing and finance, the term cannibalism refers to bringing a new product online that cannibalizes sales on an existing product. So what can happen is you can have a great idea for a product that is in a product line. It's the latest in a product line. And you, madam, you're the marketing person, okay? You come to me. We got this new product in our product line. It's an upscale version of what we've got right now. We're very excited about it. So, Mr. Finance Grumpy Cat, please tell us yes. And I say, no. All you're going to do is your revenue is going to be nothing but cannibalization of the existing products in that product line. You sell this, you're going to sell exactly that much less of your others. Come back at me. Could. Can you come up with anything else?
How would you know?
Well, don't ask me that, because I am the finance person. I am Darth Vader. asthma. much better. Okay. Okay, there's two different pieces going on here. One is that if I am aiming at a product that is upscale, then that's not what I'm selling. The upscale people aren't going to buy this lower scale stuff. I'm penetrating a new market. I'm not cannibalizing an old market. I'm penetrating a new market. The other argument is this. Look, if we don't do this, someone else is. So we can cannibalize our own revenues, or we can keep some competitor from cannibalizing our revenues. So the two arguments, and there's valid arguments on both sides. But the bottom line of it is that if there's going to be cannibalism, okay, was there going to be, I'm going to lose revenue on my existing products. First of all, am I really, or am I aiming at a new market that wouldn't have bought my other products anyway? And the second thing is, even if I am going to cannibalize some of my own revenues on my other products, if this is a great idea, then we're not the only ones who are having it right now, and someone else is going to make the product and take away our revenues. So it's a balancing act. Yes, cannibalism has to be considered, but you also have to consider what could happen if you don't bring on new products. Now, there are all kinds of interesting real-life variations on this. One of them that I could give you, you might be a little, not quite old enough to remember this. Toyota, and this is just an example, this has been happening all through the auto industry. Toyota had a really sweet, little sporty, cute almost, little mini SUV. It was called the RAV4. It was aimed at young professionals just out of college in their first good jobs, or they had been out in the workforce long enough that they had the money to afford car payments of maybe $300 a month. But it was a little darling. It was little, small, and it just was real sporty. It would go up and down the roads. But then Toyota upscaled it, made it bigger, heavier. And as such, the first thing that would come to mind is they're cannibalizing their normal-sized SUVs, because they turned RAV4 into a standard SUV, which would go right head-to-head with the SUVs that they already had in that category. But if you look at what Toyota did, and you'll see this, and I'll bet you can think of companies that are like this. What they did was they took all of their other SUVs and they upscaled all of them to bigger. And then at the very bottom, they slid in a new small vehicle. So that instead of a market with four from bottom to top, they had a market of five from bottom to top, with each one more narrowly carving out a demographic group. You might, madam, want a ginormous SUV that can drive over mountains, people, annoying bicyclists, cars. You, sir, might not want to go over mountains. The other things are cool, but you don't need the mountain stuff. So you'll want something smaller. Gotcha. I got one for you. You don't want to drive over anyone, but you do want to have enough room for groceries and, you know, maybe the occasional elk that you've hunted in the wilds of Wyoming on the top of the car, of course. Not inside. It smells like the Dickens afterwards, you know. But and then you might be one step above the cutie pie stuff. You don't want cutie pie. You don't look like you're that kind of person anyway. But you don't want a giant thing that the gas guzzler. You want something that's just good for work. You get a little respect for it and all of that. You, sir, want a tiny little nifty smooth. Have you seen those half cars? Have you seen those half cars driving down the road? What the hell? I mean, it's just like, I want to laugh. Anyway, the point here is that what they're doing is they're engaging in very serious demographic carving. They're carving up the market very seriously into narrower and narrower pieces. They are not cannibalizing. They're doing this consciously. They're making sure that they're not going to hurt one market to start product's market by starting a new product in the product line. Because what they're doing is they're simply moving each one up and narrowing the band of the target market that will buy it. But they're doing it cautiously so that they don't give up anything much in any given market. Now, you can think of other companies that have done this, auto manufacturers. Mitsubishi did it. Subaru did it. Subaru used to create a station wagon. Really? It was a station wagon. It was called the Outback. Then they changed the Outback completely to make it look like their SUV called the Forester. And then they upgraded the Forester so that it looked more butch, and it was a bigger thing. Mitsubishi is about to do the same thing in its new relationship with Nissan. They are going to take their little Sport and make it look like their Outlander Straight. They're going to make the Outlander Straight look like their heavier Endeavor. And then the heavier Endeavor is going to turn into, I don't know, something like a Sherman tank. I don't know. But that they all do this. So you've got to keep that in mind when we talk about cannibalism. Now, getting right back to this, getting back to what we're talking about here. Madam, you shop for clothes, don't you? Good, good. And sir, you shop for clothes.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, you do. Okay, good. I just want to make sure. You know, some people actually, they actually argue, say, no, I just, you know, maybe if you call Goodwill shopping, but, you know, that's not, I'm not aiming at that. But when you go into, let's say, a Kohl's, or Kohl's would be a good example, or maybe a Macy's, you will notice something a little different about women's apparel versus men's apparel. The racks of the women's apparel are much closer together. You have to actually navigate, not that I do it on purpose, but I do like the fabric, you know, but when you go into the men's section, them are wide. I do not want to get that close to you, bro, if we're both in there, okay? See, the point, though, is that that's part of consumer architecture. Also, the fact that we expect that when you walk by those clothes, you are going to feel them against your skin. I'm going to tell you something interesting. Sears Roebuck and Company, they made their fortune back in the day with Sears catalogs. They would send them to every family they could in the United States. Farm families, small town families. And let me tell you what they had in women's clothes. They had a paisley dress in two sizes. in their women's clothes. That was their women's clothes section. Then you went on, next thing, with tractors. You can't, but, I mean, can you believe it? A paisley dress in two sizes. Awesome, right? Consumer choice, yes. Now you go into an apparel store and you have hundreds and hundreds of different styles and different sizes. You'll still walk out of there. Have you ever walked out of an apparel store? Well, they didn't have anything for me. Really? 5 billion products and they didn't have anything for you? Knock it off. Get back in there and buy something, for God's sake. But the point there I'm trying to get to is simply this. This is part of consumer choice architecture. A news article that was in the paper this morning, on the News Wire this morning, H&M, one of the biggest producers and sellers of, one of the biggest sellers of apparel, they just released the numbers on how much unsold apparel they have. Did anyone see the article? $4.3 billion. Worth of unsold apparel. You see, the reality is this. For every item a clothing retailer sells, anywhere from 20 to 50 don't sell. They just don't sell. So when you're talking about the variable cost, you are talking about the cost, the wholesale cost, not of one item, but of how many items it took to sell one item. You understand what I'm saying? So, madam, you go to buy a business suit. For everyone on the shelf that sells, 5 won't. So, the variable cost that I am facing as the retailer, the wholesale cost, is not the wholesale cost of one, which I might be able to get at $12 and sell it to you at $100. It would be 12 times 6, $72, because I have to have that many for you not to storm out of my store saying they don't have anything I like. That's the reality of business right now, retail business. That's just how it is. Okay? So, what makes that an even darker story is that you know what I'm going to deal with to try to control my break even? I'm going to control my merchandise, my wholesale merchandise cost. That means that I'm not going to produce it in a decent place with well-paid, healthy, happy workers. I'm going to drive it down until I find some place where the people are still alive and they function, but they can produce it at $3 per sale or per unit. Does that sound harsh? The reality is that that's what happens when you're driven by break even, is that you got to find the lowest price. And you hope to God some do-gooder doesn't break the news that you're an asshole and you hire slave labor or whatever it is. But that's the problem that I'm trying to get to, is understand that this is a balancing act. I've got to please the consumers in this country who have a fit if I don't have tons of stuff on the shelf. But now, let me give you the other side of that. Now, I try to scare you a little bit with that, but I do want you to understand that we have tons of merchandise, hundreds of millions of items that go unsold, but we have to do it that way so that we can sell. At my art shows, I might sell 3 or 4 artworks, but I put up a muscle-bending, mind-bending 36, because each one is heavy. I have to put up the heavy racks to hold that many. Just the setup alone on my own is an hour and a half, and then the breakdown is another hour and a half. And so I have to do that to offer all this so that when people walk by, there is a better chance that someone is going to stop. Oh, my God, I want that. I have to have that. I love that. That's the only way I can do it. If I put up 5 artworks, it would be wonderful. I'd save myself money. I'd save myself bones and skin and muscles. But at the same time, I wouldn't be able to pull the consumers in. I have to increase the probability of a sale by increasing the number of possible units that I'm varieties that I'm offering. Now, there is another side to this. Have any of you ever shopped at TJ Maxx? Okay, I'm going to be honest with you. Full disclosure, I am a TJ Maxx ho. I will go in there, and I will not leave until I have got a shopping cart of stuff. Hey, the chocolates are cheap, and the pants are too. The thing of it is that you see there are these factoring markets, and there are these like very low tier companies that will sweep up a lot of that merchandise. Look, I'm not going to leave all those unbought blouses, pants, shoes on my shelf more than a month or two. I'm not going to. I'm going to put them on sale to see if I can unload them. If I can't, I'm just going to just throw them into the truck of the factor buyer and say, all right, what are you going to give me for 1,500 pounds of clothes? And they will come through for me. And they'll give me a few bucks. So what that will do is that will lower that variable cost. Instead of maybe six, I could adjust that down to maybe five, because I get a little money, maybe 20 cents on the dollar, something like that. In my own market, I actually encountered it only this past year, a buyer who came in and said, I'll take your whole inventory. They wait until they see you. You're exhausted after 2 days. You put up everything on Saturday morning at dawn. After you've driven 2.5 hours to the show, you stood there on your feet in the hot sun for 2 days trying to sell your artwork to anyone and everyone, and they wait until you're at the end of the last day of the show. You look exhausted, and then they come up, and they'll say, I'll take all this off your hands. Huh? Yeah, you take $50 for everything you got here? Man, I mean, there are two sides to me. This side of me says, you son of a bitch. This side of me says, okay, $50 gets me home. They do it in my business too. They'll just sweep it up. And then they'll put it in places. They'll sell it to upscale places that they got this incredible deal from some emerging artist. Or they'll just put it up in those places where people buy stuff for a couple of bucks to decorate their house trailer. But yeah, it happens even in my business too. And it's hard to say no when you're facing moving about 1,500 pounds of stuff a quarter of a mile from your display area back to your vehicle. Boy, that sounds good. So that's something that does enter into this. Yeah, you're going to have to buy multiple units to sell one. Include the wholesale price of how many it is to sell one. But also remember that there are places where you can unload and get rid of some of that stuff so that it's no longer on your shelves and at least you recovered a little bit from it. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.